cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're right here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
And of course, Carol, that's part of a team of 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
And Jason, you can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio every weekday.
Or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Incredible Health is a company that connects hospitals with nurses and other healthcare workers. So let's talk about what our next guest has seen through the pandemic and what the future may look like to protect vital healthcare workers. Dr. Iman Abuzaid is CEO and co-founder at Incredible Health. She joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Dr. Abuzaid, nice to have you here with Jason and myself. So tell us a little bit about what you have seen through the pandemic and kind of where we are right now.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So what we've seen is we did a pretty in-depth study of nurses throughout April, over 400 nurses, and we also analyzed the data in our database. And what we're seeing is that nurses are having a very difficult time with this pandemic, and the pre-existing issues that already existed in this industry, like staffing shortages, burnout, and stress, are continuing to happen. Only 2% of nurses have said that their facility was very prepared to deal with COVID-19.
And so, knowing this business as well as you do, both the sort of the practice and the logistics of it, as well as the economics of it, Dr. Abuzaid, like, how did this happen? Was it just a matter of unpreparedness? Was it just the size and scope of it? What do you owe it to?
I think it was both the shock. It was a shock to the health system. Mm-hmm. It really was. And when 59% of nurses are saying that they don't have the adequate personal protective equipment to practice safely, you know, that just shows the lack of preparedness and the shock to the system. Now, I know that hospital executives are scrambling to fix this, but
it's still a problem. So you're saying it's still a problem.
It's still a problem.
So where is the breakdown? I mean, you understand this world. And you know, Jason and I have had a lot of conversations trying to understand, you know, the supply chain, and everybody talked about shortages, and we had federal officials saying we're doing everything we're getting all the equipment everybody needs, and yet there doesn't seem to be the case. What happened? Was it a case that we needed a federal initiative and didn't get it?
Yeah, I mean, I think all around, whether it was the hospital industry itself or government, it was just the lack of preparedness was quite shocking here. And it wasn't just about, this is not just about personal protective equipment that's lacking. I mean, even the infection control protocols that hospitals needed to put into place, there were not clear guidelines coming from the CDC. So each hospital had to scramble to put their infection control protocols in place.
You know, it's interesting, Dr. Abuzaid, you know, we've also talked a lot to, you know, as Carol mentioned, sort of the heads of hospital systems and sort of how it's going to be for consumers of healthcare and how we may interact with doctors and whatnot differently going forward. How's it going to change the nursing business? I mean, you have an MBA from Wharton. You've been involved in startups. You worked at McKinsey. Like, you understand the business side of this really well. How does the business of nursing change going forward?
Okay, so even before the pandemic, there was a massive nursing shortage. Our health system needed another. We will be 1 million nurses short by 2024. It is one of the biggest skilled labor shortages we have in this country. This pandemic is expected to make it even worse because our demand for healthcare as a country continues to go up. Now, we don't see that changing after the pandemic either. This is generally a group of workers that's underappreciated, overworked, and there are simply not enough of them. And so we'll need to continue doing whatever we can to increase the number of nurses in this country.
What does an average nurse, I hate that saying an average nurse, but what does a nurse make today?
So the national average is around $80,000 to $90,000 for a hospital nurse. In states like California, it's a bit higher, like $110,000 or $120,000 average.
So why aren't people going into nursing?
Number one, it's a very tough profession, and it's a challenging job. The second is that nursing schools don't necessarily have the capacity to train more nurses. There are always huge wait lists for entering nursing school, and they're still challenging to get in. Also, the training of nurses is inadequate. Even after nursing school, getting appropriately trained in a specific specialty has a lot of limitations because it's very expensive to train a nurse.
And so you're obviously in the business of technology and using technology to maybe help eliminate some of these bottlenecks. How does it work? How does it work going forward, and how can technology help us here?
Yeah, so in our case, for Incredible Health, we work with over 200 hospitals across the country, including top academic medical centers like Stanford and Cedars-Sinai. And what we've done is really we've automated entire processes of hiring and screening using software. So we've automated the screening of the nurses. We've automated the custom matching to specific employers that meet their needs. And the end result is hiring happening in less than 30 days instead of it taking 90 days, which is the national average to fill a nurse position today.
Wow. So how much of an impact is that making? Only have about 40 seconds left here.
Yeah, so what we've already seen, I mean, what we've seen in the survey is that for ED, emergency department and intensive care nurses, they're getting hired even faster in 19 days these days because of the pandemic. And so we see this acceleration continuing to happen, and technology and hiring continue to be adopted across health systems in this country.
Well, all really right. Some great insight.
Yeah, really good. Really good. And I think underreported, candidly,
totally.
This shortage that we're talking about. Great work. We really appreciate it. Dr. Iman Abuzaid is co-founder and CEO of Incredible Health, joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Fascinating background she has, working at McKinsey and MBA, and has worked for a COSLA-backed startup as well.
Right.
Really interesting.
Like, pulls together, you know, it comes at it from so many different perspectives, right? So, fascinating.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
So, Jason Kelly.
Yeah.
Don't you remember that Bloomberg Business Week cover? I think it was last October. Everything is private equity right now. I think you had some involvement in that.
I did. I do remember that. I remember it quite well. It turns out it was fairly prescient and an unbelievably powerful and important story in the magazine this week. Heather Perlberg wrote it. Max Chafkin edited it. He is the features editor, of course, of Bloomberg Business Week, here to tell us all about it on the phone from Queens. MC Hammer, what's going on?
Hey there. How's it going?
This is a big story. It's a long read and pretty intense. Tell us what Heather and you guys found when it comes to private equity and the medical business.
So as you said, you know, PE, private equity, has, you know, sort of been all over our economy. And, of course, the healthcare industry is, you know, one of the biggest or maybe the biggest industry in the U.S. And so probably wouldn't surprise you that private equity investors are in there. What Heather did is she looked at a specific field, dermatology, It's definitely not the only field where there's a lot of activity here, but it's one where it's sort of everywhere. Some people think as many as 10% of the dermatologists in America work for a private equity firm or work for a company that's backed by a private equity firm. And what's interesting, you know, kind of when you get into it, you start to see some of the ways that our healthcare system isn't working particularly well. And, you know, one of the stories we've seen, and Heather gets into this in the piece, but one of the stories we've seen with the coronavirus is you have these ER doctors who are being either laid off or furloughed at a time when everybody in America is focused on healthcare. You know, you'd think watching the news that this would be a great time to be in healthcare, but it's of course a terrible time, and it's because of the way these companies are structured. They are, you know, they're structured in a way where they need cash. They've been growing really fast. A lot of them are very leveraged, and when you start not having elective procedures, when demand for the services goes down, that's when things start to break down, and there are some of these kind of stories that really seem pretty terrible.
Well, and it's interesting. So, you know, these dermatologists, right, dermatology practices, I mean, they were not deemed essential, correct, through this shutdown?
Yeah. No, it's all very much a gray area, and state and local laws, there are all sorts of differences. But the lead anecdote in the story, which is very memorable, is of one of the bigger chains in the country. It's a large dermatology chain in California, which, you know, right at the height of the crisis, was basically calling people up and telling them to keep their Botox appointments, among other things. And Heather listened in on a sort of a Zoom conference that was held for the industry, where the CEO of the company sort of explained himself, saying that, you know, this is just like a grocery store where if they're selling flour and meat, it's not like they're going to stop selling candy. And so the analogy would be that, you know, offering Botox is like selling candy. And, you know, that obviously makes sense maybe from a business point of view. These companies definitely need to keep revenue if they want to survive. But of course, many doctors, and this is a conversation that's going on everywhere if you talk to doctors, feel very uncomfortable with this. They feel like they are being asked to choose between sort of profits and traditional medical ethics.
Well, and I think that's a really important point, Max, that Heather dives into pretty deeply into the story, which is, you know, there are some workarounds, and private equity is about nothing if not workarounds in terms of being able to structure deals in certain ways. I mean, this is a business, the healthcare business, that the American Medical Association, I believe, essentially says, listen, this isn't just your regular old sort of like P&L that you're managing here. And yet they sort of found a way through these managed companies to basically buy these things up, and they're only sort of getting bigger, right?
Yeah, they're only getting bigger, and they probably will continue to get bigger because the economy is so bad right now, and these practices are failing or close to failure. And, you know, big private equity firm comes in with a lot of money, you know, that's going to look perhaps more attractive than it did before. I think we should say, and it's probably an important point, that they're not everything about this industry is bad. I mean, they are, and what they'll say when you talk to them is that they are expanding access for people. You know,
right.
One upside of growth is that you know, these practices are fanning out. It's potentially, you know, more convenient for patients. Also, you know, a lot of people have talked about how hard it is to be a doctor in America, and you know, helping these doctors get paid a little bit more money. You know, that all sounds like a good thing. The problem is when you get these sort of private equity roll-ups where they've already cut a lot of costs, and then all of a sudden they try to do like another roll-up, you know, taking two sort of large groups and merging them together, and you basically, you know, according to Heather's sources, and she talked to lots and lots of doctors, you know, that's where you start running into problems.
Yeah.
Well, and I love there's a quote in there about serving two masters. You can't serve patients and investors, so it gets a little tricky and complicated. It's a great read, and as Jason mentioned, there's a lot of information here, so highly recommend everybody check it out in the magazine. Max Chafkin, features editor at Business Week, joining us on the phones from Queens, New York. Thanks, Max.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so let's get back to the world of economics. It's where we started the show at the top of two with the Fed releasing the minutes from its latest meeting. And those are must-reads at this point as we try and discern what happens next, especially when it comes to monetary policy in this crisis. Let's break it down with our team, Alex Harris, bond reporter.
I believe they are the Long Island Ladies.
The Long Island Ladies.
Queens.
The Queens Queens. Okay. The Long Island Queens.
Queen of Queens.
All right. We're going to do that. Alex Harris, bond reporter for Bloomberg. She's on the phone from Long Island City, Queens. Yelena Shalechevich, senior U.S. economist, Bloomberg Economics. She's on the same island, the island of Long. So, Yelena, I want to start with you. What'd you hear? What'd you see in those minutes today? What's the most important thing we need to take away?
It's pretty close, actually, in terms of geography. But, as for the minutes, two things really struck me. So first is about the state of the economy and how much policymakers are concerned about the medium outlook. So this struck us when the statement was released already 3 weeks ago, but the minutes provide a lot of detail about policymakers' concerns about long-term unemployment. So if people lose jobs and stay away from work for quite a long time, they will lose skills. So they already are talking about this in the minutes and about how much uncertainty there is there about future economic outlook. So that's one thing. And another thing is was the policy tools discussion. So policymakers obviously reiterated the message that we heard from them in recent public remarks. The minutes noted that they are committed to using its full range of tools to support economic growth. So that includes QE policies, that includes lending programs, and they stand ready to adjust and adapt those existing facilities to better tailor them to business needs. So what was really interesting in this set of minutes is how they would like to reinforce forward guidance. This is a very powerful tool the Fed used in the past. They used it extensively during the financial crisis, and they would like to either introduce some sort of outcome-based approach when they tie the path for policy rates to some sort of macroeconomic variable such as the unemployment rate.
and or they can do date-based approach when they just say, okay, we're going to keep the rates low until some future date in time. So they used both approaches back in the financial crisis. You know, some of them were quite successful. Some of them were probably not. So it's not very clear that, you know, these are the ideal tools. But there's a lot of discussion among policymakers about how to reinforce the message, so to say, open mouth operations from the Fed.
All right, so let's bring in Alex Harris, and I'm curious if you're more interested in the Fed or that 20-year bond auction. I mean, it seems like investors are very happy to buy up anything that the U.S. government puts out there, whether it's 20 years or 30 years.
You know, real quick on the 20-year, you know, obviously this is the first 20-year auction we've seen in 34 years.
Right.
So it's hard to draw any sort of comparison. But, you know, when the Treasury was debating about, you know, a 50 or 100-year bond, and, you know, dealers and other people in the community, in the financial community, kept saying, no, 20-year, you know, this is a good sign that you're going to get that interest from the pensions and from the life insurers. In terms of the minutes, you know, some of it is, you know, Yelena mentioned policy, you know, its full range of policy tools, but I think we need to just quickly mention what they did not talk about was negative interest rates. So I'm hoping, and I think a lot of people in the financial space are hoping, that this puts the negative rates discussion to bed. You know, Fed funds futures implied rates were back in positive territory. So I think people are like, okay, that's over. So the fact that there was no mention of it, you know, I think was key. You know, there was also a brief mention of yield curve control, which is where they would cap rates at some point on the curve at a certain level. You know, and someone had sent me some commentary, and, you know, this could be a way the Fed could be seen as sort of expanding, committing to an unlimited expansion of its portfolio. You know, if they do end up going that route, and I don't think they've put that to bed yet. So there's something to it there, and something to be mindful of as we listen to, you know, members of the FOMC come out and speak. You know, and then the other thing is, at least for the Fed and those funding market wonks, you know, the SOMA manager, Lori Logan, laid out the rationale for why they didn't feel the need to move that interest on excess reserves rate higher. And,
right,
you know, participants were sort of split during the last meeting, you know, as to whether or not they were going to do it. And it seems like they're like, nah, we don't feel a need to. We're okay here. But, you know, one of the things, if I could ask them anything right now in regards to that, is, okay, well, if you don't feel like the bottom of the range is pretty well protected, then why did you make the move higher? You know, why did you make the tweak in January? So something's not necessarily adding up for me, and I would be curious to know more about, you know, why January warranted such a move.
Right.
Now with rates at the zero lower bound, it doesn't.
All right, guys, listen, thank you so much. Really appreciate you weighing in on some of the day's news, including those Fed minutes. Yelena Shaletyeva, senior U.S. economist at Bloomberg Economics, on the phone from Long Island, New York, along with Alex Harris, also weighing in on that 20-year bond auction. Bond reporter at Bloomberg News from Long Island City, Queens.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
So, Jason, it was pretty hard to find an investment haven, as we know, as the financial markets were selling off, right, initially because of the virus. And yet, Emily Chasen writes in our weekly Bloomberg Green segment that while not many ESG fund managers, their mission was necessarily to protect investors from a global pandemic, it turns out maybe a lot of their funds did. So let's get into it in our Bloomberg Green segment. Emily is sustainability editor at Bloomberg News. She joins us once again on the phone in New York. So Emily, tell us a little bit about this story this week. We often talk about ESG funds and their mission, and I feel like over the last decade or so, we know that you can kind of have an ESG mission and also get performance, but it sounds like you found out that even during this market downturn caused by the virus, that some of these ESG funds actually outperform maybe some other investments?
Yeah, well, so it's interesting because ESG portfolio managers, for years, if you talk to them, they'd say, you know, there was a market downturn in that quarter and we actually outperformed in it. So they've actually sort of bet on resilient companies, even though they were kind of planning for a climate crisis or finding, you know, managers they thought were good and adaptable using ESG scores as a proxy for that. They turned out that they had also sort of bet for this global pandemic. So when you look at portfolios and indexes overall, BlackRock did a really interesting study this week where it found that in the COVID-19 crisis, 94% of ESG indexes outperformed. And if you look like from 2015 to 2018, when there were market downturns, like 75 to 78% of ESG indexes outperformed. So there seems to be a pattern here.
Right. And yet, Emily, you know, there's not a lot of available inventory out there for the regular old 401k investor to really get into these investments. Why?
Well, this is what we've sort of examined this week in our Green newsletter, was why these ESG funds that are providing this downside protection are missing from your 401k fund. And it's a little complicated. Bloomberg does have an ESG fund in its 401k, but very few companies have done it because they're worried that they're compromising returns for that. But now that's not really the case anymore. If you look at, you know, how this performed, and this is the first big test for a lot of ESG funds, that only about 80 ESG funds actually have a five-year track record that are large ESG funds. So this is the first big test, and they seem to be providing some sort of economic benefit. So I think people are going to wonder why they're not in their 401k plans.
It's a great question, right? But I felt like for a time, you know, especially when ESG funds were kind of newer on the environment or the investment, you know, landscape, that they didn't always perform as well. But we've seen things change, especially as more companies, you know, your big companies, your S&P 500 companies, have really kind of embraced ESG ways.
Yeah, there's kind of been a transition from socially responsible investing of the days of yore, that it was just kind of finding companies that they didn't think were bad and taking them out of the portfolio, like tobacco or alcohol or weapons, right? But now ESG is much more focused on risk management, which is a good downside protection strategy. And then also they're more focused on using all this information and this new ESG data to find opportunities. So a lot of ESG funds are much more heavily exposed to tech and healthcare, which has actually outperformed in this latest crisis, and they're underexposed to fossil fuel, which, you know, we saw oil go to zero. So that was a good move.
And Emily, we're always fascinated between, you know, some of the connective tissue in terms of what types of investors are drawn to these types of investments. Millennials, we're always concerned about them. You know, I have a millennial co-host in Carol, and, you know, I worry about her, you know, not being exposed as much to 401ks. You know, these are the things I worry about. But in all seriousness, like, millennials, not so much into retirement savings historically, right?
Yeah, well, I'm technically a millennial also.
Oh, there you go.
But millennials are...
You really are a millennial.
Barely.
You're an actual millennial.
But so millennials, a lot of them graduated in like into the recession of 2008. A lot of them are, you know, underinvested in their 401k, haven't had a lot of money to spare, have a lot of debt, you know. So, but millennials who do have money, a huge portion of it is what's actually in their 401k. That's a huge portion of their household investable income.
Interesting.
And millennials are really excited about ESG. They would really like to invest in it, but they don't have that option in the 401k, which is the biggest pool of assets that's available to them for investment in this way.
Emily, I do wonder if you wonder about this as well, that because, you know, of what we're going through right now, this health pandemic, and we're talking a lot about some of the big problems that are facing the global society, whether it's climate change or whether it's future pandemics, whether more companies kind of embrace ESG ways and they become, you know, that there will be more offerings for ESG funds. I wonder if we're going to see that kind of on the other side of this virus. Just got about 45 seconds here.
Yeah, there's been a ton of inflows actually into ESG funds, so I wouldn't be surprised about that at all. And there's been a ton of news coverage, a lot of interest in the space.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Good to catch up with you, Emily Chasen, sustainability editor at Bloomberg, part of the Green Team, the Bloomberg Green Team.
Love it.
Timely launch of that earlier this year, because I do think we are, to your point, Carol, we're thinking about this much more holistically. We're thinking about our world, as you like to say,
I know.
In all facets in many ways.
Right, and just some of the big problems. And you do wonder, you know, we just talked about, was it the bite yesterday, about Unilever and a bunch of other companies that are saying, come on, we've got to work together, public-private partnerships to tackle some of these inequalities that are in our world.
Check out all of their work at Bloomberg.com/green.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Back with us is Yana Barton. She is co-director of growth equities at Eaton Vance, and she joins us on the phone from Boston. Yana, nice to have you here with us. How's it going?
It's going well. There's some sun outside. I'm seeing a lot more green on my screen. Life is good.
Life is good. You know, I want to ask you something, because one of the big stories that Jason and I have been talking about, and then we'll get into, because we love to be able to talk stocks with you, but we're hearing a lot of financial firms, whether it's JP Morgan and others, Citigroup, you know, thinking about moving a lot of folks out to the suburbs. And I'm just curious, what's the talk in Boston about, because of the virus and nervousness about commuting to big cities, you know, that companies are kind of rethinking where their offices are. And I'm just curious what you're hearing about in Boston, and particularly maybe among the financial sector.
Well, majority of our employees are obviously working from home right now. There isn't any talk of having alternative location outside of Boston right now, but I think many of those conversations are certainly taking place, and perhaps the answer is not one or the other, but maybe a hybrid of, or maybe a sort of a three-case scenario where you still have headquarters that are central for your investors, for your clients, for corporate access, but also have the flexibility of working from home and having alternative sort of satellite offices. So I think many of these options are on the table, and I'm sure are being discussed as we speak.
And Yana, as an investor, as you look at companies, many of which I think you're invested in, and they sort of work through this, does it change? Like, do you have to model differently? I mean, or is it just sort of one of the sort of softer factors that you work in? I mean, I do wonder how we think about, because you guys do, I'm sure, sort of intensive work on all of your portfolio. Like, do you think about companies differently in terms of, you know, how aggressive they are on this, what their cost structures end up being, how radical does it need to be and for it to enter into your analysis here?
Oh, that's a great question. I think depending on the industry, the real estate cost is a different input. So for retailers, obviously, it's a very different input than for someone like an Amazon or a Google, mm-hmm. right? So I think it's more of a question of the overall cost structure, and firms that do have the flexibility and variable cost structure because of the model of their own business and that agility, that's a long-term tailwind. So the more flexibility you have in your model, better it is for you. And I think that's part of the reason why the profitability stream of companies within tech and perhaps the next gen secular winners is so much more attractive, because these sort of embedded costs are less of an overhang on them.
So what do you make of where we are in the markets? And I'm just curious, what if any buying have you been either suggesting or looking at right now, especially since, you know, we're, you know, seeing a little bit of a rally again this mm-hmm. week, but it depends on the week, you know, in terms of the tone of the market. So where do you think we are? And I'm curious about anything you might have been buying into right now.
It's interesting, because I was looking at my notes. The last time you and I spoke was kind of in the midst of the most severe drawdown that mm-hmm. we saw in the yeah. marketplace, and we were doing a ton of buying then, which felt very uncomfortable, and I remember we had a lot of conversations about that. But the reason why I bring that up is because this unevenness that we're seeing, both in terms of reopening for business and different states doing their own thing, that's the same thing we're seeing in the marketplace. So while on the surface you see the market, albeit still down year to date, the average company is underperforming the cap-weighted index almost two times. As I look at the market here, not inclusive of the rally we had today, we have S&P down just shy of 9%, but the average stock is down 17%. And more importantly, when you look at specific sectors like consumer discretionary, you've got one outlier, which is Amazon, up over 30%, without which that sector would be down 14%. 14%. Again, the reason why I'm providing this context is on the surface, it looks like there's a lot of green, but not everything has recovered to the extent that we might believe it has. So like specialty retail area of the market that was bruised during the downturn is still recovering. So that's an area where we're interested in and unnimbling here and there. And healthcare is also an area that has been in the headlines where biotech and pharma has done really well, but other companies like med devices and life sciences have been left behind. So that's also an area where we're sort of playing the laggards.
And so what do you look for in a specialty retailer at this point, Jana? Because I feel like we are starting to see some very distinct winners and losers, or we were before the pandemic set in. And I wonder how that, how this experience or sort of looking at who's done what and how everybody has handled this changes your opinion, or do you look at different things? How does the pandemic change that calculus?
Well, apologies for my dog there, by the way.
I've had my 2-year-old daughter scream on air, so don't no apologies.
It's all good. It's all good.
I think home improvement is an area that's obviously topical because we had reports today of Lowe's and yesterday of Home Depot, and all of us are stuck at home. I don't know about you, but I'm doing a ton of nesting. So when you see the results from Lowe's that are coming in where you're not only seeing positive comps, but double-digit comps that they haven't seen since, I think, back in 2007, I think there's some durability to that, right? So there are some company-specific things that they're doing in terms of their cost structure and margin improvements, but also sort of do-it-yourself is, you know, buyers coming back, and we're doing a lot more buying for outdoor spaces and such. So, again, Home Depot versus Lowe's, we have a position in Lowe's because it's less expensive than Home Depot and has lagged Home Depot year to date. So that's a company-specific story. We're also intrigued by the off-price retailers as well. Again, all of those stores are closed. I'm certainly waiting for the opening. I can't tell you how much, but that story is not going away. And if anything, I think those guys will have the upper hand in terms of the inventory that will be stuck in the channels and will wait to be moved. So TJ's of the world and others, I think, will be just fine because they have the liquidity, the scale, and the infrastructure. So they're just two examples of what is intriguing to us.
But they'll be doing it differently, right? They're going to have to be with social distancing and so on, right? I assume it's going to be a little trickier going back.
Absolutely. I think the point that you're bringing up is an important one, which is we really need to focus on multi-channel retailer, meaning, you know, and many have showcased and demonstrated the strength you can have from having the digital presence. So it's ordering online, it's picking up at a curbside pickup and whatever it is. So
Jana, we got to run, but you're absolutely right. The multi-channel is going to be important.
Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, you can always listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.